Welcome to the Ellison Report, our weekly broadcast podcast hybrid journal of politics, policy, and the people, where we discuss the issues rather than react to the news here at the home of the 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. By the way, that debate taking place throughout the week of March 7th through March 10th, and more information at weaa.org, of course, or at Baltimore Debate on Twitter. I'm your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, here at the WEAA studios, Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, Charm City. Senior producer Andre Melton is on the board of steel. Our good friend, associate producer Tyron Rice, is not here in studio today, but that's all good. So he's always present, pulling the show together, all assembled here. To give you some exceptional programming in public radio, especially Black public radio. That's right. No, it's public radio. It can't really be, you know, either or. It's just public radio. So I had to throw that out there. Anyway, you can find me at Ellison Report on Twitter. So talk about Super Tuesday. Lots to digest, analyze, and basically. We have to make up a word like punditrophesize. about what happened this week in over a dozen states in both the Democratic and Republican primary. So we have a special edition of the Ellison Report to flesh that all out. We're going to extend the segment. In fact, we have with us our very own Catalina Byrd, or WEAA's very own Catalina Byrd. Political strategist, media analyst. She joins us by phone. She's at Catalina Byrd on Twitter, and also the Honorable Peter Groff, former president of the Colorado State Senate, also former Obama appointee as well. He's at Peter C. Groff, and they join us both by phone. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Excellent. So first at the top, I just want to get your first impressions of exactly what happened on Tuesday. Some very interesting signals, indicators that we got there. So I at the top, I just want to sort of have a sort of overall sort of freestyle impression of, and starting with Catalina, of what you felt about Tuesday. What were some takeaways, some key things that we did notice and some things that we didn't notice?
I think initially what we do notice is that Hillary Clinton won the same states for the most part that Donald Trump did. And so if you look at some of the narratives that have been being written about the similarities of them and how she was a proud Goldwater girl and those things, I think that's very telling as to what a Clinton presidency would look like. But also the states that Donald Trump won didn't give him enough delegates to even make it to a first ballot runoff. And Rubio's showing, though it looks like, he only won one state with a silly caucus, is more than they thought he would win. Mm-hmm. And that's important to note.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
Just a couple of things, and I think it's interesting what Catalina just said about both Clinton and Trump winning the same states. It is interesting to me that Clinton really has a lock on the African-American vote, particularly in the South, so much so that Bernie Sanders said, I'm not even going to contest there. I'm going to go to states that are less colorful, if you will, than those states across the South. One, and two, there is a clear chasm now in the Republican primary between the establishment candidates, whether that's Senator Rubio or Governor Kasich, and then the anti-establishment candidates of Trump and Cruz and Carson, where they got nearly 70% of the vote on Tuesday.
Mm. Catalina, looking at the numbers, looking at the percentages, the margins that folks won by, and I'll start with the Republican side, looking at Donald Trump's numbers in states like Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia, those are the states that he won. Still, on average, he's not getting above that 35% on average threshold. So does that say something there? Does that speak to maybe the amount of favorability towards Trump in the Republican Party, maybe a lack thereof? There's still a lot of Republican voters that don't like him?
That's what I was going to say. It's very telling because while he can't get over 35%, what they've seen consistently, because since Iowa is higher GOP turnout in these primaries than usual, which means that the base is afraid of a Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. You hear Paul Ryan dialing back the language. You hear other people inside the party saying, okay, it's time for us to get serious again. Mm. And so that turnout with him still not being able to amass even 35% is indicative of the party trying to fix itself on the Trump problem they made for themselves, essentially.
But then Peter, he jumped over the 40% hurdle in Alabama. He's gotten 43%, Massachusetts 49%, actually. And that's a northeastern state. And Tennessee just shy of 40%. So is that saying something there as well? I mean, maybe Trump's popularity rising or Republican voters finally feeling like, okay, this is our guy. This is our one, you know, what's the cat in the Matrix? You know, this is our Neo, essentially. You know, so he's the chosen one. And so they're coalescing around the winner, so to speak.
I think some of that, but still, I mean, you have a situation where he wins and he can't get, you know, above 45%. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts, that alarming at 49%. But there is a telling story, again, between those folks who are the anti-establishment folks getting 65-70% of the vote, and then the establishment candidates who just can't seem to break in. And at some point, the party's going to have to decide, probably within the next week, what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with this? Because you can't go to a convention in Cleveland where you're going to have somebody who has 80% of the delegates, and you're going to tell that hall, no, that's not our candidate. We're going to come up with somebody else. They're going to have a huge problem on their hands if he can't find a way to get to that magic number of 1237.
Talking to Catalina Byrd and also Peter Groff here on an extended segment of the Ellison Report discussing breaking down Super Tuesday results. And so I immensely respect your analysis, both of you. So that's why I called you on for an extended segment. And so we're doing that right now here on the Ellison Report. Catalina, I have to ask you, looking at the Democrats, and so some things that we know, and I know obviously the big news of the night, everyone focused on Republicans, but some interesting things happening there on the Democratic side as well. You know, I'm noticing, like for Hillary Clinton, just 50% of the electorate in Massachusetts, but under 70% in her home state of Arkansas, or at least her husband's home state of Arkansas. But then, like, you know, 78% in Alabama. What is that kind of saying about Hillary Clinton, about how solid or not that she is in certain regions?
Well, I think that what I hear in the narrative, which I think is kind of just disingenuous on a mainstream media platform, is that shows that she has the support of the black voting base. When really, if you look at those states, and they're in the Bible Belt, and again, these are the same states that Trump won in large numbers, she is resonating with white nationalists just like Trump is. I think that's what it's telling about them. When you look at where those states are, when you look at those populations, you look at the median income and overlap with the race and class dynamic of those states, it's not about the black vote there. She is not all the way shored up in the poor white vote, but you can see that's who she's resonating with.
Really?
Even though it's not who she's openly targeting.
That's interesting. Wait a second, though, Catalina. But so what about, like, blue-collar white male voters bucking for Bernie Sanders? I mean, that didn't happen a little bit down south, and that didn't happen in places like Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma?
Well, you've always heard me say, and people don't always agree, but I've been saying it for years on air and every platform, sexism runs deeper than racism. So, again, it's the intersection of class and sexism. Those blue-collar white male workers are going to support a Bernie or a Trump strictly for the fact that they are not women. And that has no difference in party lines, which is why, you know, my fear is not of a Trump presidency, but if Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, regardless of who the GOP's nominee is, they will be our next president. Because we've seen it, especially with her, work against her in 08 when she was running against President Obama. And it works against her when you really start to dissect these numbers and where her votes are coming from and where she's winning. their sexism is still very prevalent in this race, and it's not in the sense where the white feminists are talking about how she gets characterized. It's easier to see if you analyze the actual data of who her votes are coming from and who her money is coming from.
Peter, is that something we haven't talked about enough, is that gender gap, you know, particularly in the Democratic primary? That's really what this has been all about, is this huge sort of gap between men and women voters, or at least this perception that we're not talking enough about as far as male voters within the Democratic primary, and then moving forward in the general election, having reservations about a female president.
Well, that certainly wouldn't be their that certainly wouldn't be their most recent reservation, because they had reservations with the black guy on top of the ticket the past two times as right. well. It has been interesting to listen to Secretary Clinton kind of change her stump speech and really begin to talk about breaking barriers, and not necessarily just hammering the fact that she would be the first woman to receive a nomination or potentially be president. She's kind of tried to broaden that message and talk about the barriers or the ladders to success, as she mentioned Tuesday night in her remarks. And so I think she's trying to deal with that issue that Catalina just brought up, in terms of trying to get white males to come back to the party by talking about the barriers that everybody, particularly middle class and poor folks, are having in terms of breaking into success with regard to economics and other things.
So she's starting to guzzle a few more pints. You know, that's what you sort of changed that image. And Catalina, so you weren't bothered, Catalina, by how Bernie just sort of resigned before Super Tuesday, and, you know, running up to it on that day. He sort of resigned to just competing in the least blackest states, or the least colorful states in terms of diversity. That wasn't bothersome to you? I mean, what does that say about Bernie Sanders?
It says he's a realist. I mean, the man can only...
But he's a revolutionary, though.
Okay.
So suddenly he's a realist.
And it's not written anywhere that revolutionaries can't also be pragmatic in their thinking and realistic as well. You know, I feel like those things don't have to be mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. And so with the way that we have been complicit in the shaping of the narrative as mainstream media around Hillary, especially as it pertains to black people, we know that he's talking to issues that resonate with us, but the media is not telling those of us that aren't listening to him that. They're changing. There's a disingenuous part of the context of the conversation, and so he made a smart move. He knew that Debbie has been stealing superdelegates for Hillary and trying to rig this election for Hillary as her homegirl in every way possible. You know that the media has been complicit in that, in both Hillary and in Trump, in the way that they're selling them to the people and the masses. And so realistically speaking, where could he still make a good showing? I don't think it was that. He's not afraid of diversity. I mean, you have Killer Mike, and he lost Georgia in large numbers. Killer Mike, T.I., a whole group of artists who supported President Obama are supporting him, and people aren't still making the connection. It's not Eric Garner's daughter is in his commercial. People still aren't making the connection. And they're still saying he's out of touch when he's speaking to, in the most genuine and authentic way, the issues that are impacting us. So if he can see that that's not a story that's being told honestly, and he's not being framed that way, why would you even give yourself or your followers the hope that they could really, you know, be a contest in some of these other states for Super Tuesday? And I respect that, because that is a lot how apathy happens. When you overpromise to your base and you can't deliver, they get hurt emotionally in the process, and then they don't return to it.
Hey, Peter, you know, one thing about the Democratic primary turnout was that it was very low, particularly compared to the Republican primary electorate turnout. And so what does that really say about the extent of Hillary Clinton's black support? Because even though the sort of big narrative, the accepted narrative, a conventional narrative, is that she's doing very well, very solidly with black voters, still the turnout was very low. So, one, what does that say about what happened on Super Tuesday, what's happening in this Democratic primary? And two, what does that pretend for the future?
Well, I think it depends on where you look. And looking at the numbers in my home state of Colorado on Tuesday, they had the highest turnout with regard to caucus attendees on the Democratic side, because the Republican one was not a binding caucus. But on the Democratic side, higher than even 2008, where I was very much a part of that effort for then-Senator Obama, when we thought we had just blown the doors off in terms of getting people to come to caucus. So I was surprised by the number that Bernie Sanders' campaign was really able to drive in Colorado. Yeah. And two, I think when you look at Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia on Tuesday, South Carolina, before that, if Hillary Clinton goes on to receive the nomination, and at this point, Bernie Sanders would have to win 60% of the delegates moving forward to capture the nomination, which is not going to happen. Hillary Clinton can thank the African-American community for this nomination. You can't look at the numbers in those states and the percentages that she's receiving in those states with high African-American participation on the Democratic side and say, well, you know, she did okay with African-Americans. She is doing, in some cases, even better than the president did. So there is a very, very long and deep tie, and we can talk about whether it's a good tie or a bad tie or a misinformed tie between the Clintons and African-Americans. But right now, the African-American community is fueling Secretary Clinton's campaign and her march to the nomination.
So do we see some kind of Catalina as far as Democratic convention? Do we see Bernie trying to sort of bum rush the Philly show and come in and pushing this narrative that, you know what, you know, especially with this whole superdelegate process, this was all rigged from the start. And so they're going to head into Philly, you know, trying to push up against Hillary to become, you know, perhaps a running mate, to somehow leverage something more when they get to Philly in July.
Oh, I believe that's absolutely what happens. And what's interesting is, and Peter said that African American votes are fueling Hillary. We are, but also the turnout as well, which is very telling going into a general if she is the nominee. And I've never been able to fully figure out what it is about it, but what I do know is in election years, when Democrats don't like their options, they stay home. Republicans will vote for a Democrat out of protest if they don't like the Republican nominee. But there's some sense of civic engagement that keeps the GOP from not voting. And it's something that Democrats do when they don't like it. So if African-American votes are fueling Hillary, that's very, very scary going into a general, because if the white votes of the Democratic Party like whoever the Republicans, or can stomach whoever the Republicans actually end up nominating, and it's not her, those votes then go to the other side and again ensure a GOP presidency.
Hey, let me ask you real quick, Catalina, because you're saying something there as far as, and you're touching on some questions that I now have about the Republican primary, and how attractive, because I feel like, okay, a lot of folks, even folks like Mitch McConnell, for example, from Kentucky, this is just me, host prerogative, I just feel like he's faking the funk a bit, and others as well, on how much they dislike Donald Trump. I think privately they like him. They see him as the winner. And so that's a big question heading into the general. We're presuming Donald Trump will be the nominee. He's going to get a lot of white votes, right?
Oh, of course.
And but even more than we're letting on. We're just assuming that there's this big chunk of the Republican electorate. There's a big chunk of independents, and there's also some, you know, a lot of white Democrats who are just going to be totally turned, who are currently turned off by him. But
this is the first presidential election year that millennials have outnumbered baby boomers. There is a large chunk of white males over the age of 50 that feel like the country is becoming too brown.
Right.
The policy and the politics are changing a narrative that has allowed systematic racism to work on an institutional and structural level and policy for all of their lives. That these are the people who want their country back. And it's not about Republican or Democrat. It's generational. And it's very race-based. And those are the people that they're not really anticipating coalescing around Trump and could make him the president. They should be very afraid, because that's a very real fear. They are seeing the browning of America. They are seeing their children outnumber them. The millennials are typically, though, considered an unreliable base, obviously are showing up, and you can tell in the numbers of Rubio and Sanders, who both did college tours and reached out to millennials specifically, and they're afraid. And that fear will move people who even think that he's crazy to vote for him. Fear is a very, very debilitating handicap.
And Peter, I want to go to you on this question as far as, like, you know, how much, you know, for being a very an electorate that's woefully lacking in diversity, how much of a factor did race play in the Super Tuesday results? What's going on there, and what should we be doing as far as increasing those turnout numbers amongst millennials? Because on average, millennials just don't vote beyond like a 45% threshold. It just sort of there's like a ceiling that millennials have imposed on themselves as far as voter turnout is concerned, from what we've been seeing these past several elections.
Well, I'm not sure how you increase their number.
Yeah.
Other than really concerted efforts to reach out to them. Or even open up the process to them. You talked about kind of the superdelegate concept, which, by the way, on the Democratic side has been there since the early 80s with the Hunt Commission. But, you know, if you continue to make this an insular process, millennials are going to feel that they're not part of it. So, I mean, so you've seen candidates, particularly Donald Trump, who really is running his campaign via Twitter. Charles and I have talked about off air who's actually working on the campaign,
right?
You know, who's setting up all these different rallies that he's having. A lot of this is reaching directly to the voters, which I think is causing the GOP establishment a great deal of fear, because they can't control him. They can't control the narrative that we've talked about. And so I think if you're going to get them to vote in really high numbers, you've got to go directly to where they are and use the items that they use the technology that they use to try and drive them to be part of this process and to drive them to the polls for the remainder of the primaries and then in November.
And you know what, Peter, I'm also curious, are black voters, black and brown voters, scared enough of Donald Trump? So we saw also some very peculiar numbers showing up in places like Georgia, Virginia, also Alabama, a 50% increase in the share of black voters participating in the Republican primary. I don't know if you were aware, but we also found those numbers yesterday compared to 2012. It was like 3% black voter participation in the Republican primary back in 2012. Now it was like it was something crazy like 9% in Virginia. Is that fear of Donald Trump? And two, are black and brown voters going to be fearful enough, or is that something that can motivate them against a presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump?
It could have, but again, coming back to Debbie and Hillary and their I don't know what you call the female version of a romance, but this friendship that has allowed them to be in the positions that they are, it's splitting it. So we know that millennials are more progressive on social issues and in line with what Bernie's saying, and through a combination of things between the media and the DNC and Hillary, that growing base is being split when it really needs to be galvanized at this point against the Trump presidency. And so the fear is real. The issue then becomes generational. It depends on some issues we're having infighting inside of our own communities about which Democratic candidate to support. And that has really dangerous implications if we don't figure it out soon. And I think they need to figure it out ahead of Philly to really have enough time to galvanize and mobilize by November.
Yeah, Peter, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Charles, it's interesting because I have time. I live in Virginia now and talk to a lot of people in the run-up to the primary on Tuesday. And there was some interest because it's open here. So you walk in and you say, I like to vote in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary. And so I talked to a lot of people, and they were considering voting on the Republican side, but voting for Governor Kasich or voting for Senator Rubio or Senator Cruz because they wanted to try and stop, if they could, Donald Trump's march. That's some voters. Some voters also said, well, you know, he's not going to be owned by anybody. And so I think there's some intrigue about that. But I wonder now, after his kind of slow roll to reject David Duke and reject the KKK, and I would love to see polls now after this kind of slow roll in terms of his not really coming out, in terms of what the media thought should have been with full speed ahead on rejecting those folks. And so it would be interesting to see now how African-American voters view him. And whether that's going to be enough to increase turnout. Generally, voting against the devil has not really driven numbers to where they need to be.
I mean, it's going to be interesting. Democratic Party obviously going to try to portray him as sort of like this reincarnation of George Wallace, so to speak.
The reason that narrative doesn't work is because the people that are black that are supporting Trump, they already know about his family's connection to the KKK. They know his, so they're not caring about how he didn't answer that question.
Right.
What it is that unfortunately our community, we have figured out how to become as racist as people are towards us. And because of how he talked about the Hispanic population is why there is a portion of the black community supporting Donald Trump.
Right.
And that KKK statement isn't going to matter to them because that's not why they're with him. They're with him because he's the guy they believe is going to kick out the Mexicans who are taking our jobs.
Right.
That's their narrative.
We haven't even had that conversation yet either, as far as because we've seen polling data suggesting Trump winning anywhere from 25 to, and there was one poll that had him getting, you know, perhaps even 40% of the black vote. That's very troubling for the Democratic nominee, who's going to need 85-90% at least of the black vote to get over that hurdle on their way to the White House. Right, Peter?
Yeah, particularly in states like Virginia, North Carolina, Charles, your home state of Pennsylvania, Ohio. You're absolutely right. There's going to have to be that threshold number of 90% at the least to make them competitive, to make the Democratic nominee competitive in November with regard to black votes in swing states, to make sure that that map President Obama has created stays the same. You're absolutely right.
All right. That about does it for our extended segment. Thank you both for hanging in there and giving us such great analysis. We didn't even talk about Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and how relevant or irrelevant they are right now. So,
let me
ask you, Catalina.
You can do that after March 15th.
I think I can get about another, 30 seconds to a minute here. Catalina, I want to throw that question out to you. I mean, how does Ted Cruz factor in all this? I'm not even thinking about Marco Rubio right now.
Rubio is going to be the nominee. Ted Cruz is about to fizzle out, and you'll see it soon. But after the 15th, with these closed primary states, we're going to be having a totally different conversation anyway.
So you think Rubio will be, did you say Rubio will be the nominee?
Rubio's going to be the nominee when it's all said and done.
Because it'll be contested. Okay. Peter, real quick, jump in there.
I think after March 15th, if Marco Rubio cannot win his home state, then he probably needs to go sit down somewhere. If you go to a contested primary, or if you go to a contested or brokered convention, it's going to be a Speaker Ryan or the former Governor Romney that comes out of that. But I don't think you can tell 80% of the people sitting in that hall in Cleveland that the people they just rejected over this primary should be their nominee.
And I think that there's a perception problem there that Marco Rubio has. Rubio needs to slow down when he talks. That's just me. And two, I know that his slinging insults at Trump to sort of beat Trump at his own game, he thinks that works, but there's this kind of young, mischievous frat boy kind of aura around him right now. I don't know if it works. I don't know if it is not working for a lot of folks I'm talking to, and I'm not sure if that works for a lot of those older voters, like you said, Catalina, earlier, who reliably come out well, both of you said and acknowledged, who reliably come out, especially in a Republican primary. I'm just not sure that that's working for him. So
Catalina made a great point, mm-hmm. Charles, earlier when she said that people know who Donald Trump is.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's rude, when he's annoying, when he's obnoxious, that's who we expect him to be.
Right.
When Marco Rubio does it, we're kind of taken aback, like, what are you doing? And you're right. He's kind of youngish, and he kind of comes across as being the annoying guy who used to sit across from you in high school.
Right.
And it doesn't work for him.
He's a dude that, like, you know, threw toilet paper all over your tree out in the front yard and is, like, laughing about it. And, you know, yeah, that's how he's coming off.
Your mom.
And I'm not sure if that's working. But it's very interesting, Kathleen, you would say. We'll come back to that, you know, especially as we get closer to Cleveland. Thank you both for being on. Catalina Byrd, at Catalina Byrd on Twitter, and also Peter Groff, at Peter C. Groff on Twitter. Catch them when you can. Thank you both for being here. We're going to have Ron Fischot, former publisher of Campaigns and Elections magazine. He's coming on next on the Ellison Report. Here at the home of the 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. The Ellison Report is made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, more at onenessmobility.com, and with support from BE Strategy, more at strategybe.com. Welcome back to the Ellison Report. We have on with us the founding principal of Claris Research Group, Ron Fischot. He's also a former publisher of Campaigns and Elections magazine, joining us for our special segment, an extended segment, as we break down the Super Tuesday results from March 1st, looking at the Democratic and Republican primaries. He joins us by phone. Ron, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. So I'd like to kind of get your first kind of takeaway impressions of what happened on Tuesday night. As far as, you know, you're breaking down those states. Let's start with the Republican primary. Some very interesting sort of indicators that are happening there. Donald Trump looking like the presumptive nominee. But when we get into March 15th, we could have a whole different conversation, correct?
Yeah, very much so. I think that, Trump winning seven states is a big win. There's no question about it. I do think that his support softened in the last few days before the primaries, largely because of the issue surrounding David Duke and white supremacist groups and how Trump handled that. I think that probably hurt him in at least four or five states. It didn't knock him out in some of those states, but I think it did cut his margins down. But at this stage of the game, Trump still needs to win 51% of the remaining delegates to get the nomination, and because he's got a little less than half of the delegates that have been selected so far. And so that means this race is still on. It still could be won or lost by anybody. And the primary is coming up this weekend, and in 2 weeks from now will be very important and will help determine whether Trump has the ability to lock this nomination up by mid-March or whether the contest still goes on.
We're talking with Ron Fischot. He's founding principal of the Claris Research Group. Go to clarisrg.com. I did want to throw that in there also on Twitter. At MSL underscore group. Definitely check us, a nonpartisan public polling firm. Also, you have Lunchtime Polling, lunchtimepolling.com. Don't forget to check that out as well. Some interesting insights from Ron. Ron, I want to ask you, kind of looking at breaking down the Republican primary results, again, looking at that, Trump can't seem to get over that it's like an average 35% threshold, even though, like, in places like Alabama, 43%, Massachusetts 49%, Tennessee just barely 40%. What's that saying? So there's still room for a really competitive race here. There's still room for someone to take on Trump, either a Ted Cruz or a Marco Rubio.
Right. That's the big thing that hasn't been answered yet, you know, is is Trump's support limited to the mid to low 30s, mm-hmm. or even into the 40s, or whether he can grow and get a majority of support among Republican voters and delegates. And that's the question. He didn't hit 50% in any of the primaries yesterday, mm-hmm. and not that he was supposed to, but he didn't hit it. And so it indicates that more people are voting for other candidates at this point than who are voting for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to win the nomination, particularly in a head-on race, if it gets down to that, against either Cruz or Rubio, he's going to have to win majorities.
And that assumption is that Marco Rubio is that guy or that selected one for the Republican Party establishment, whatever that means, that the establishment, you know, for lack of a better term right now, everyone's throwing that word around. So, but I mean, he just doesn't perform. Tuesday, all he gets is Minnesota. And he's very well behind in the delegate race. So really, is that a possibility, you think, of Republican primary voters coalescing around a Ted Cruz? He doesn't have many friends in Washington, especially on Capitol Hill.
Well, you know, it takes somebody to beat somebody, and if the opponents of Donald Trump expect to beat him, they have to have one candidate who can beat him.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they can settle on Cruz or Rubio is a question that has yet to be answered. You know, a lot of the party establishment, frankly, would have trouble being for Cruz, and many of them would probably rather have Trump elected than Cruz elected.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at the Democratic side. So what did you see there? So Hillary Clinton obviously doing very well in the South. She did manage to get one Northeastern state. Bernie Sanders just resigned to letting her do her thing in the South. He pretty much, he got a Southern state, but then he goes out West and also Midwest. What did you see there? What are some things, some interesting kinds of takeaways or indicators that we're not noticing, you know, kind of moving forward in this Democratic primary fight?
Well, I think the key thing is that for Hillary Clinton to win a primary, she needs a state that has a significant African-American vote.
Mm-hmm.
In the states where there are very low African-American votes, like Vermont and Oklahoma, for example,
mm-hmm.
Sanders can do very well, but when you get into the southern states, where significant percentages of the Democratic vote are made up by Black voters, then she wins overwhelmingly. So there's really a big racial difference in terms of the makeup of their support coalitions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm real curious about, because I noticed what you do on Lunchtime Politics, when you're sort of breaking down the polls, you always kind of start off with just a really simple, quick analysis on President Obama's approval numbers. And so how does that factor in to we're now starting to kind of see an emerging narrative of Hillary Clinton as close to being presumptive nominee for the Democratic primary? It looks like she will be. But how now, when you're heading into the general, you're going up against someone possibly a Donald Trump, how do those presidential approval ratings, how do those impact her?
Well, I think that's an excellent point, because those approval ratings can have a big effect on who wins the general election. If the incumbent president, let's say, is at a 45% approval rating or lower,
mm-hmm.
It's likely that he will hurt his party in the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
If his approval ratings are, say, 52 or 53% or higher, it's likely that he will help his party in the presidential election. And if they're somewhere in between, it probably means it wouldn't have that big of an effect. So for Hillary Clinton, it's going to be important to her winning the general election that voters like Barack Obama and current Democratic administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will be a factor in the government.
And you know what I'm real curious about, because you were once publisher of Campaigns and Elections. Campaign is an elections magazine, and I've had some folks from CNE on the program before. Looking at the business of politics, the strategies, the techniques. So what have you been noticing in terms of the campaign management techniques on both sides of the aisle? in terms of the polling methodology, in terms of the technology that's been using. What are some things that are kind of standing out to you as we're moving forward in these primaries, we're heading to the conventions?
Well, of course, technology continues to change campaigns. It's speeding things up, and it's adding a whole new layer of required expertise to run campaigns. Mm-hmm. Because you can't just run a campaign on television and radio and newspaper or direct mail the way you did 10, 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You have to have a significant online presence, a significant presence in online social networks, and in smart candidates who have the money of using the tools of technology, mobile devices, for example, to keep track of voters and voter contact and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is, Donald Trump is sort of breaking all the rules of modern campaign activities. And he's not doing a lot of the things that these other candidates have been doing. And people in recent years have been gravitating towards in terms of campaign tactics and technology and management. He's just sort of putting himself out there and has minimal grassroots organization work, even though he has a big grassroots following. Mm-hmm. And so his approach is very different, and we'll see if it works.
I'm real curious too. I mean, could we see, say if we have a hypothetical Trump v. Clinton matchup in the general, is there something sort of a generational clash there? So could it be where you have Trump, because he's been very adept at using social media and using tools that are typically associated with millennials, and then Hillary Clinton not? Do you see some sort of evolving sort of generational conflicts there? Because some folks have been asking whether or not some millennials may gravitate towards Trump, and that may create some generational split.
That could happen. Hillary Clinton is not doing well among Democratic voters who are under 30, 35 years old. Mm-hmm. Sanders is beating her among those groups by big margins. So she has a problem with the younger voters. Interesting thing is that both Clinton and Trump are about the same age, and both of them have been public figures in this country for about the same length of time. So they're well-known individuals. They're about the same age. But one opportunity that I think Trump would have against Clinton is that Trump appeals more to independent-minded voters, and younger voters tend to be more independent-minded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Ron Fache. He is president of Claris Research Group. It is a nonpartisan full-service research and polling firm. It's in D.C. Check him out at lunchtimepolitics.com. You can get his newsletter, subscribe to that, as well as former publisher of Campaigns and Election Magazine. Ron, thanks so much. We do want to have you on again, so really appreciate the insight.
We'd love to. Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back here at the Ellison Report, home of the 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're back at the Ellison Report, lactose-free politics, policy, and the people. We're going to talk about a new app that's out. It's been out for some time, the ZipApp.com. It's sort of capturing a number of things. It's capturing, obviously, consumer sentiment on a number of issues, from relationships to products. But it's also been capturing some very interesting data with respect to this very contentious, very caustic and hot, which is the way I love it, 2016 presidential race, particularly presidential primaries that have been taking place on both the Republican and Democratic sides. Here to talk about that is Rick Maliti. He is the founder of Zip. It's Zip the Question Answer app. Once again, you can go to the ZipApp.com, and they've had some very interesting findings. It's sort of like a digital poll. Rick, tell us a little bit more about the Zip app and how that works, how you're collecting that data, because you've actually been quite on the mark with some of these primary outcomes and results.
Absolutely, Charles. It is my pleasure to be on your show. Thank you for having me. The Zip app is really cool because what it is all the content and all the questions that are generated on the app are created only by the users. Mm-hmm. So everybody who downloads the app, regardless, has the ability to ask and answer questions with 100% anonymity. So the questions we're getting on the app are really the way Americans feel, and they're not holding back. So they're asking all kinds of questions without fear of any repercussion because of the anonymity. So it allows them to answer honestly, which is even more important because most polls, people are always honest in polls when you go face-to-face with a pollster or you get a phone call. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people tend to hold back. The beauty of app is the users create the questions so you know what's on their mind, and it's an ongoing conversation, and then they answer with absolutely no fear of repercussion.
And you were sort of spot on as far as some of, you know, some of the results that we saw from Super Tuesday on March 1. You know, like, for example, you asked the question, you know, does John Kasich, governor from Ohio, have a chance to come in second in South Carolina? Well, this is pre-Super Tuesday. It was like, no way, 66%. You know, as far as who's going to finish second, you know, you had Rubio, 64%, 36% saying Kasich. So, you know, you've been, you know, rather on the mark as far as, you know, somewhat on the mark as far as what users have been saying. What are the breakdowns like? So it's mostly... mostly men, women breakdowns. What's the average age of the user, the Zip user?
The average age right now is running about 33 years old. We tend to skew a little bit older. While there are quite a few younger people on the app, the beauty of the app is when you set your preferences, when you download the app, you could actually set your preferences to only interact with people or an age group that you select.
Got it.
So say, for example, you don't want to interact with teenagers. You just slide your slider up and eliminate that group. And so, therefore, all your conversation would be with peers or people that you're selecting. So the age group, though, the average age of our users, right around 33. Day-to-day, it varies day-to-day on downloads. And sometimes we get 39, sometimes we get 26 as an average age. But generally, the average age is in the mid-30s.
And I didn't see that as far as Super Tuesday. What were you seeing, or what sort of activity were you seeing, and what sorts of data or outcomes were you seeing pre-Super Tuesday and also maybe a little bit after the polls closed on Super Tuesday?
We were definitely seeing a polarization over Trump. There was no doubt, and that's obviously significant and very well demonstrated on all the shows that you watch. Mm-hmm. So the polarization was there. I think what you're finding is, again, the honesty on the app, because, again, all the content is created by the users. So we're only providing the platform for people to ask these questions. And the beauty of it also is that the way the program is written, all profanity is blocked. Mm-hmm. We have very strict user codes. So we have monitors who actually oversee all the questions and make sure that nothing racist appears, nothing bigotry appears. We're very sensitive to that, and that's at a very important part of our guidelines in our company. No bullying, no threatening questions. And if they are, they're basically either deleted or suspended. Mm-hmm. But we also don't censor. So we allow people to speak their mind as long as it's not overly offensive or vulgar. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's actually very family friendly. We have we get emails all the time from parents saying they go home and zip through questions with their kids, because in the settings, you can actually eliminate the mature settings. It comes when you download the app, the mature setting is off. You would actually have to opt into it. So you're getting a very family-friendly app that's very educational, yet very fun. I mean, we're being called the Google of opinions. Some people are calling us the Tinder for the intellectually curious. You know, the app is really blowing up socially. And I really think it's because it's allowing people to express the way they feel without fear of political correctness and without fear of repercussion.
And you're saying without, you know, people can participate without fear of political correctness. So and there are a lot of, well, here are two questions here. One is, you know, you have a lot of these social media applications capturing voter, consumer, public sentiment. So the first question, I guess, is, you know, what is sort of really differentiating Zip app from a lot of those other applications. And then we have such a multiplicity of these applications, social media applications. And so why is this a good thing or a bad thing for democracy? I'm sure you'll say a good thing, but, you know, how good is it for democracy?
Well, that question actually comes up quite a bit because the whole app is based on democracy. Mm-hmm. Because the app is so simple. It's actually written for older people like me that aren't super high-tech savvy. Mm-hmm. And so there's only really two functions. You could either ask questions or answer questions. And so the simplicity of it is the beauty of it. We have a patent pending on it because it's that unique, though, because it's not like a poll or it's not like a survey. While there's dozens of those kinds of apps, mm-hmm. we're the only app where you could literally just ask one question, something that's on your mind, and send it out and start seeing the results. Also, you can't comment on our platform. So no one can write back anything, you know, mean to you or bully you. You see that on Facebook all the time. You know, you might put something out there and then you start seeing all this vulgarity or racism come in or things like that. And we don't want that. We want people to be able to ask a question, put their two corresponding answers on there and see what people think. And it comes back to you in a percentage and it comes back very quickly. And if you ask a question for, and you could set how long it's going to be out there for, but if you're asking it for about a week, you're getting statistically accurate data.
Mm. Yeah, that's why I like that. That's why I called you. That kind of raw, kind of keep it 100 data. You know, you just want the straight questions. You want to see those answers and kind of like how people really feel. Because that's sort of one of those dilemmas with polling, is folks being afraid of being really honest and real candid. Talking with Rick Melitti, he is the founder of Zip, the question answer app. Also on Twitter, you can follow them at the Zip app, Zip, Z-I-P-A-P-P, the Zip app on Twitter. I have to ask you, Rick, so as far as the breakdowns, the demographic breakdown, so I see you're doing men, women, you know, you're breaking it down by gender. You're also capturing age. You know, you're kind of at the end of the millennial age generation block. You're also kind of doing some breakdowns as far as cities and states, you know, locations. Do you have plans, or do you already do this? Are you breaking it down by other types of demographics, race, income, level of education, partisan affiliation? Is that something you're doing now or that you're looking at doing in the future?
Well, the users are doing it for us by the questions they ask. Mm. So those are kinds of questions that come up in everyday conversation. Mm. We see them on there quite a bit. You know, there's questions that are indicative of income. People might say, do you go out and buy a $100 steak dinner?
Right.
You know, is that excessive?
Mm.
And then we could tell by the way people answer somewhat their economic, you know, if people are saying, no, that's no big deal.
Got it.
Because what the answers are also written, you know, in our vernacular. They're written the way people speak.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're written by the people.
Mm-hmm.
They're not written by pollsters, or they're not written by people who write surveys. So they're very raw, they're very real, and they're very genuine. So people are we're getting those kind of answers. People are asking race questions. People are asking questions about preferences. They're asking because they're very curious about who's using the app. So they themselves are doing their own research because they want to see the results. So they're getting their own breakdowns just by the questions they're asked.
So you kind of just to encourage sort of the fun use of the app, you're avoiding that. You're avoiding kind of you yourself as Zip app breaking down those subgroups, those, you know, those other, you know, whether it's income or race, level of education. You're encouraging the users to kind of find that out for themselves.
They do. And in turn, we get the data and it's all aggregate. So we can cross tab it and we can actually figure it out ourselves. And we could see, you know, who's really using the app. Not only, you know, because you're absolutely accurate. You know, we have the geography that tells us a lot. Mm-hmm. Then you have questions that are just questions that, you know, people would have in conversation. And so we're getting the raw answers that allow us to cross tab and get really solid data.
Mm-hmm. So
it was really interesting. I mean, I give you just on the
last,
one of the more important issues that just came through was that the ruling that the Supreme Court passed down on the Apple issue,
right.
You know, whether Apple should unlock the phones or not. And it was really interesting because we saw a lot of questions of people that were, you know, very, very pro-America. We were seeing that come through very a lot. And obviously the fear of terrorism is a big issue, and everyone was very polarized and unified against terrorism. But when that question was asked before the Supreme Court handed down their decision, the voters of app of the Zip app, the people, the guy who asked the question, all the answers came back, and it was about 60%. That said, no, we should not release, the Apple should not have to unlock that phone. And so that surprised me, because, you know, you look at all the other data, mm-hmm. and you're like, you're thinking, oh my God, for sure, the people that are using the app right now are going to say, yes, unlock the phone, because it's going to theoretically going to help, you know, in the cause against terrorism. But surprisingly, 60-40 went with the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court, and this is question got much more than what we need for statistically accurate data within a margin of 5. Mm. Okay, so, you know, we were well within that margin at 60-40. The Supreme Court made the decision that actually reflected the way the people of the United States feel.
All right, we've been talking with Rick Maliti. He is, did I get that correct? Maliti or Maliti?
Maliti.
Maliti
is Maliti.
Okay, excellent. Rick Maliti, he's founder of Zip, the question answer app. If you want to check it out, you want to use it yourself, it can be downloaded on the Apple, speaking of which, the Apple App Store, or also on Google Play, or you can go to thezipapp.com for more information at the Zip app on Twitter. Rick, hey, listen, thanks so much. We'll be in touch. Please keep me posted on some more of those results as we get a little bit deeper into 2016.
Absolutely. If you ever see any questions on the app, just let us know. We're happy to provide you with the data and come back on the show.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll do that. All right, take care, Rick. And that wraps this special edition, a special sort of extended Super Tuesday edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Go to ellisonreport.com for more information. Made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, more at onenessmobility.com. Support from BE Strategy, more at strategybe.com. We're at Ellison Report on Twitter. And remember, catch us the week of March 7th through the 10th for the first major Baltimore mayoral debate of 2016 at Baltimore Debate for more info. Join the conversation at Baltimore, hashtag Baltimore Debates, all while you're listening to the home of the 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.